Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. Today's episode is a slightly modified version of the Substack I sent out yesterday. I wanted to take the chance to review both where the show is, where it's been, where it's going, especially given the fact that we are a little more than a year out from the 2024 election. So at a broad level, I really find myself increasingly saying, okay, we get it, when listening to myself or another guest or host state some 2018 vintage wisdom when it comes to populism's effect on American politics. You know, back before I started the show of Sagar back in 2019, we were really looking for an outlet to express a lot of these realignment-centric ideas because it didn't feel as if a lot of the changes we were just noticing as young guys out in DC were being actually recognized in the broader media space. So now that I've had the chance to do 350 plus episodes, I thought this would be a great chance to kind of go over some of those themes, how they've affected my thinking, how they mean for things moving forward. And I'll also answer some common questions about the show's structure because we put out so much content that folks have a hard time actually keeping up what we're actually saying. So really kicking this off, I want to talk about the first era of the realignment, basically from, you know, 2015, 2016 to really late 2022, right around the 2022 midterms, which were a surprise given the fact that Democrats not only kept the Senate, but performed much better in the House than anyone thought they would, where a lot of those realignment themes really came to place, especially given the strength with suburban voters and the fact that certain populist candidates did not perform as well as they should have, given certain, election denial issues that came up. The first era was rooted in three events that I really encountered when I first came to DC, obviously. 2015, 2016, you're looking at the Brexit vote, the rise of democratic socialism via the Bernie Sanders campaign, and of course, Donald Trump's prize victory over Hillary Clinton. From that period, I really came away with these big issues and questions that everyone, whether they agreed with either policy conclusion that came from these issues, would have to engage with. These include everything from how globalization went wrong, which left whole parts of the country behind, why the seemingly placid Obama years led to a half decade that was defined by populist rage across the globe. I just read two books by Jonathan Alter about the first part of the Obama presidency. The first is The Promise. It's about President Obama's first year. And the second was The Center Holds, Barack Obama and His Enemies. The second book is about the 2012 electoral campaign and its impact going into 2013. And if you guys are looking for a chance just to read a book that will transform you and take you into a place that you just have not been in a while, it's those two. 2009 and 2012, 2013 feel as if they are not merely, let's say, a decade ago, but actually two or even three decades ago. Everything that's being discussed doesn't feel as if it's operating in the same universe we live in today. Things are so different. The assumptions are so different. So once again, thinking of how this world of 2009, how this world of 2013 led to the world of Trump and populism is a deeply important one that I think we spent a lot of time engaging with on the show. Another big topic, the collapse of the post-World War II foreign policy consensus, and something that was really illustrated by the buyer's remorse in the electorate after two decades of post-9/11 forever wars that were broadly perceived as failures. Another topic, whether the United States was/is in a second Cold War with China. Why Donald Trump's Republican Party overperformed with working class voters of color. The roots of the urban versus rural divide. Why did elite 2000s era assumptions about the rise of China not play out? The realignment of moderate suburban voters against the Republican Party, the degree to which America's changing demographics advantaged one political side over the other or made certain policy outcomes inevitable, the late stage 2010s tech industry's increasingly hostile relationship with both the left and the right, and more. Those are broad issues that if you go through the catalog, you will find some type of episode engaging with. And as I plan the next era of the show, it's pretty clear that all of the above questions and topics, while initially groundbreaking or potentially edgy, especially before COVID, they're now broadly accepted, even in the parts of the Acela corridor where one is most incentivized to deny or ignore them. the Biden administration could have abandoned President Trump's trade war with China. There is definitely a world where Make America 2013 Again became the rallying cry of the center left. Instead, the Biden administration launched a potentially fatal assault on the Chinese semiconductor industry, and it would have been easy to leave a potential TikTok forced sale slash ban back in 2020, especially given how popular the TikTok app is with the young voters that Biden needs to turn out in 2024. Everything I just said is not necessarily an endorsement of every single action the Biden administration has taken. It's simply the recognition that the underlying assumptions undergirding DC have shifted, which you can really describe as realignment, if you will. The question then is that if most everyone agrees with, or at least takes these questions and realignment errors assumptions seriously, what actually should we do? That's the question that part two of the show is focused on answering. And of course, you'll be hearing more to come from this space. All that said, I wanted to share some of my favorite of the first 350 plus episodes the show has put out. I've been getting back into podcasting lately. I go through phases where I'll spend 3 months listening to audiobooks, and then I'll spend another 3 months back in podcasts, and I am in the podcast side of the cycle. So I definitely know when you come to a show late, it's kind of hard to find what episode you would really want to listen to that may or may not have aged well. And if you are just trying to catch up with things you missed because of a high production volume, it's always great to get some suggestions. So this list is also included in yesterday's Substack, but I'm just going to read out some that I think have really aged well and would really provide a great way of understanding this first era of American politics. Once again, you could come up with your own conclusions, but I think these episodes all capture a specific idea or moment that people are really going to think of when we're setting the table. First, we've got the episode of Rana Ruhar, The Path to Prosperity in a Post-Global World. This was about Rana's book, Homecoming. She's a Financial Times columnist. I think the homecoming debate about deglobalization is just incredibly well stated and very, very, very interesting. Next, we have Chris Miller, The Chip War and the Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology. This is obviously the episode about semiconductors, which are the new oil. I hate to use that phrasing because it's super cliched and saying that people say data is the new oil. Forgive the cliche in that case, just because it is a good shorthand for how centered around semiconductors our politics and geopolitics would be for the subsequent future. Next, I had Peter Layden with his episode about California being the future of American politics. This was an interesting one for me because I don't typically hear a lot of California optimism in the discourse here. But what Peter convincingly did in all of his writing, which you all should check out, is he took a zoom out from the very specific qualms one could have with San Francisco or Los Angeles or California itself and said, hey, like, let's look at America in 2050. Does California's underlying strength or do California's underlying strength actually provide an opportunity for optimism? This kind of gets at something that happened when Sagar and I did an episode of Balaji Srinivasan, where Balaji was articulating a lot of problems in the US. My pushback to him in that case was, well, okay, in the late 1970s, we could have listed all these examples of things not going well here. Things obviously looked better in the 80s, 90s, and even early 2000s. How does one separate a unique tactical problem from a long-term weakness? Key task in politics. Next, we have Catherine Boyle of A16Z with her Getting Serious About American Dynamism piece. I think the American dynamism idea and framework, even though it's coming obviously from a self-interested venture capital perspective, is just a hyper useful one. And I found a lot of people who aren't even in venture capital find it as a useful dynamic for how optimism and innovation could actually serve useful functions. Next, speaking of A16Z, Mark Andreessen on Everything. Obviously, that was a pretty wide-ranging episode with Sagar. Hit a lot of different topics. Hard to really summarize it, as you could tell by the horrible title. It's called The Need to Build, Web3's Value, Political Realignments, Collapsing Trust, US History, and More. When you see a title like that, you definitely know that I am sort of up late at night and I'm not putting quite the level of editorial control I need on myself there. Next, you've got Peter Zion. This is actually definitely the biggest episode Sagar and I ever did. It's named directly after Peter's latest book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning. Look, Peter can be pretty hyperbolic, but I think he did a great job of being both entertaining as a guest while also introducing this deglobalization idea. Like, once again, this is an episode that should be listened to with the Rana Ruhar episode or my episode in December about how geography and like regionalization is the future of American politics. Next, AEI's Matthew Continetti, What is the Future of the Right in a Realigning America? This episode is all about how the right stands at the midpoint between the 2020 election and the 2024 election, all the underlying issues that Matt has done a great job of looking at, especially through his book called The Right, really captures how folks need to be thinking about the next few years. Because, you know, depending on how the primary goes, depending on how the 2024 election goes, we're probably going to be in for another few years of intense debates about the future of the conservative movement. So that's always deeply helpful to engage from a foundation of serious thought and analysis, as Matthew always provides. Next, got Evan Osnos. He did a great book on basically called Wildland, and it's just sort of a real survey of the United States in the year 2022, looking at how things are, looking at what our problems are, looking at the broader themes, while also not trying to offer those convenient 10 little policy options at the end. I really enjoy that type of writing, and I think he, George Packer, you know, et cetera, do a great job with that type of topic. Next, Amy Chua, her episode on her broader work around tribalism as the fall of Kabul happened was just a deeply enjoyable episode. It's definitely one to get a lot of outside / not normal listener inbound about. For these last two, these y'all should definitely check out. Of course, Antonio Garcia Martinez on America's 30 Years War was a great job of bringing both Antonio's tech background, but also his deep interest in philosophy and history to the fore. Next, we've got George Packer, another one of those great surveyors of American politics, how America fractured and the way forward. Definitely check out George's books in the bookshop. And last but not least, we've got Frank DiStefano and Michael Lind, both on realignments and populism. Also note, Michael has a book coming out next month, and we'll be doing a great episode on that. All that said, I will wrap with just like a really useful / straightforward articulation of like the other products that we put out and monetize the show through. Because once again, this is something that's said sometimes at the end of an episode, sometimes it's said in the middle, or it's said in a Substack, and I want to provide this in a very straightforward way. So here is how we monetize the realignment and how you can or cannot integrate yourself with that. So first, we've got the Supercast. Every 2 weeks, Sagar and I release a question and answer plus a bit of unpaywalled free discussion for subscribers. This is the primary way that we independently fund the show. And of course, we've got a recording tomorrow or today for the upcoming Friday episode where we'll answer questions. So if you are a subscriber or you haven't subscribed yet and haven't submitted any questions, click the link and check out the stuff at the top of the show notes. You know, this is really, as I said before, the main way we fund and produce the show. It's great that we get the support of Lincoln Network and the Hewlett Foundation, but the only way to maintain editorial independence is to have the knowledge that we can go our own way if necessary. Next, speaking of Hewlett, we've got the Hewlett Foundation when it comes to monetization. So 2 years ago, I did a great episode with Jen Harris, who was then the director of Hewlett's Economy and Society program. She gave us a very generous grant to support the show. And the key thing about the show is that the grant means that we don't have to pursue clicks with these episodes. I'll definitely say there are some episodes like Eric Weinstein, a Mark Andreessen, or a episode with someone like, say, Peter Zeihan, that's obviously going to really be a banger and put out really big clicks. But what's cool about, I think, both this format and what I think needs to be done right now is you need venues where I'm not just thinking, okay, how do I get this the maximum clicks possible, versus thinking, okay, we've got a really dedicated set of listeners here. This show is frankly like shockingly popular for being a think tank podcast. How do we really deliver like decision makers and people who are actively thinking through these episodes content that's worthwhile for them? So as we seek to kind of get that balance together, having a foundation via Hewlett's foundation is super helpful. Finally, the last big question I get is, why have you launched a paid edition of the Substack when there's already a subscription Supercast? You all are throwing so many different subscriptions at us during a difficult time. So look, I'll just say up front, it's a tough economy. We all have way too many subscriptions going on right now. There is zero expectation that folks who are listening are going to like listen to or pay for every single thing we put out there. So want to just get that out of the way. Secondly, I'll just note some like technical things that kind of drive me to think this way. So one, the Supercast and the Supercast Q&A episode, that's really Sagar and my joint project. So obviously, not only do we release the exclusive content together as co-hosts of the interviews and discussions, but we actually co-own the LLC that owns the actual podcast. So I launched the paid version of the newsletter because I wanted a venue for my work that's just totally independent of Sagar, a place where I can, you know, write, or at least figure out how to write. I've never spent much time writing. It's a thing I definitely regret from not focusing on as much during high school and college, but a space where I could put out good product, develop my ideas, all those good things. And, you know, for tax and liability purposes, I did not want to involve Sagar, because the last thing someone wants when someone is not working on a product is to actually have to pay taxes on any revenue that's generated from that project. So the way it works is the Substack will send out a subscriber-only post every 2 weeks on Fridays, which is typically going to alternate with the Supercast. You know, as I mentioned previously, of course, you have the Supercast subscribers who paid the generous lifetime membership of $500 for that lifetime. So they are automatically given access to the paid newsletter as well. I just threw a lot at you all, but I just want to say, like, I'm so thankful for everyone's support up until this point. I'm excited to come back with a new episode on Thursday, and I appreciate everyone giving me the flexibility to really rethink things and figure out what I'm trying to do here, because I want this podcast to go on for the more than foreseeable future. I have another 350 episodes in me, but I really need to take the time to find out what I'm trying to say, what I'm trying to figure out. And what I desperately just want to figure out is, what should we actually do now that we have these realignment ideas? Now that we know that the working class is up for grabs, now that we know that suburban voters aren't voting the way they voted 20 years ago, what is the actual politics? What are the actual policies? And how does one actually perform in that environment? Because it's kind of weird to watch someone like, you know, Max Frost, the, you know, Gen Z congressman from Florida, come into power, because I'm just at the point in my career, Sagar is as well, where we are just a tiny bit older than people who may be entering into the political system. So trying to offer a avenue or a venue for them engaging in politics and these ideas is deeply important. I want to say a huge thank you to all the listeners, and of course, Lincoln Network and Heal Foundation for getting me this far. Hope you have enjoyed this conversation, and of course, we'll see you on Thursday.